Well, friends, welcome to a new season of the Right Side Up Power Shift Edition. This is a beautiful collaboration between World Vision and me, and it's a wonderful delight to be working with them in their work around the world. And there's going to be a lot of things we're learning here, a lot of things from World Vision workers from around the world, but also from all kinds of people who are at the intersection of power shifting. So this is from technology, the shifting power dynamics of what technology is doing. This is internal work, counseling. This is our economic systems shifting, even capitalism, the way that our politics work and the way that our businesses work. This is theological shifts of evangelism and what that looks like in these days. I mean, we are going to talk, folks. This season is fire. If you haven't checked out the Right Side Up season one, that's the first collaboration with World Vision and me. And it's really walking through the Beatitudes, and we're asking voices from around the world who know what it means to be blessed in that way to share with us the secrets of the kingdom and what they've been learning along the way. That still ministers to me, that season. And actually, it has become a course. So you can go to daniellestrickland.com/rightsideup, or you can go to worldvision, wvi.org/rightsideup, and you can access that season as a course with a bit of a workbook to help you through that. But this season is on power and right side up power. And I am praying that God will help us, me included, to understand how to identify my power, and then also how to use and leverage my power for his kingdom come, and to get myself out of the center of that. I'm so privileged that you're along for this journey. Check out the show notes for all the links to all the things, but we're thrilled you're here. And I pray for us all that God would help us see this disruption in this cultural season, this era, as an invitation to partner with him for God's kingdom come.
Lindsay Colley is in the house, to be more honest, in the garage and in this makeshift studio. And we're talking all things on this podcast, Power Shifting, Kingdom Come, right side up, not upside down. So Lindsay, tell me a little bit about your background and kind of what you did, what you taught, what you do now, because our conversations we have just with each other are fascinating. I want everyone to hear about it.
So I have a very eclectic background. I'm born and raised here in Toronto to immigrant parents. I was a dutiful daughter, and I became an accountant after university. And I have no particular love of accounting and auditing. And I experienced this moment, as I think many people do in some point in your adult life, where you think, what is my contribution to the world and what am I working towards? Mm. And with my business background, I decided to make the shift into something called corporate social responsibility. Mm-hmm. I can explain a little bit more about what that is, but I guess at a very high level, it's saying, hey, wait, is the whole existence or the whole reason of a business just to make profit for its owners, or does it serve some other contribution to society? Mm-hmm. And I'd argue it's the latter, and it's about, you know, businesses actually creating value for society overall. So then you start to look at things like, how does it treat people and how does it treat the planet and what's the legacy that it leaves? Mm-hmm. And it's not just about profit for the sake of money and that's just it. So I actually moved into that line of work. I consulted in it. I worked with big public companies on how to do it, how you would think about it, how you measure it, how you talk about it, what does it mean for your business model? And then I just started working in it. So I've worked at a number of public companies thinking about corporate social responsibility from inside. How does it change how they make decisions and the kinds of products that they might sell and who they might decide to partner with and what's important to their executives? I've also taught it. I typically teach it in business schools to both undergrads, but mainly MBA type students. Mm-hmm. And the reason I do that is because I think there's such an uprising, especially in the younger generations, mm-hmm. Who think about the role of business in society very differently. But business schools, and I think a lot of education systems in general, are a bit further behind. Mm. And they still teach really old school concepts. Like the whole purpose of a business is just to maximize profit. And literally 98% of the courses you take in a business school are all geared toward that. So I kind of wanted to be that little, you know, voice on someone else's shoulder to say, hey, there's another way of looking at this. Mm. Here's some other things that you might not have thought about. And I'm hopeful that as all these sort of students go out and make their mark in the corporate world, that, you know, I do sit on their shoulder and they might make different decisions. So I've taught for over 5 years, doing that kind of work. I've done a little bit of not-for-profit work as well. And most recently, I've kind of moved back into the corporate sector at a large public retail company, doing this work again, back inside, right in the corporate world, trying to change from within.
Yeah, just a larger context.
A larger context, yeah.
Okay, so I have so many questions that I need to ask you about this. So okay. One, for people that aren't really familiar, like, I mean, I'm thinking in my mind as you're talking about Shark Tank.
Okay.
Or in Canada, it's called Dragon's Den. Same exact show. And it's basically just literally all the questions and the things they care about are profits.
Yes.
Like, and if you can't, and it's percentage of profit and how much they're going to make. And they even make their decisions based on how much profit they're going to make. There's like very rarely. I mean, I think it might be one. My kids love the show. And I hate it because I think we're teaching. I said to my husband the other day, like, I feel like we're teaching excessive, horrible capitalism to our kids.
I agree.
Because it's like in an entertaining format. You know,
and it's like a game of Monopoly, same thing.
Right.
I have such a hard time playing that game with my kids because it does the exact same thing.
Yeah, and I intentionally break all the rules of the game. Like, I'm always like, here, you can have my money, like, here, you can have some of my pr-. And they're like, that's not how you play that. And I'm like, I hate this game. But that's, I think we don't really realize how embedded these values are inside of us. So I was even reading like a theology book the other day. I'm studying the book of Colossians, and it talks about how embedded, even in our language, like, I'll buy that argument.
Mm.
And it's like that argument wasn't for sale. Like, you can appreciate it, you can receive it, you can listen to it, but you can't buy it. It's like, it's such a, everything is in this, you know, commodification of everything is for sale and how destructive that is. So one, how is that awakening for you personally? Like, you're doing finance, you're doing auditing, you're doing those accounting type stuff. And you're just like, you mentioned those questions came up. Like, is this really what we want to live? Is this the bottom line? Is all of life a summation of how much money we can make? How did that come up for you in those early days? And then what did you start doing about it even in your own life?
Well, those are great questions to ask. To your point, it's so embedded in culture.
Yeah.
Right? Like, even as a child going to school, you're trying to get good grades, right? Like, these are such arbitrary markers of someone's worthiness and their value.
Right.
Right? And the same thing when it comes to, you know, business and profit, you know, it's like, okay, everyone's trying to make a ton of money. Why? For what?
Right.
Right? Okay, so you individually have it.
So what?
Right? What does that mean? What does that get you?
And then this also seems so obvious to me. And it always, I felt like I always had this like critical thought around that where I was like, those uber wealthy people don't look very happy.
No, they're not. There's some really fascinating research, and I'm going to probably misquote it, but I'm pretty sure the number is about $70,000. There's research that shows that after you make about $70,000, additional wealth doesn't increase your health or well-being or happiness in any way.
Interesting.
So it's like the $70,000 mark is the mark, you know, to ensure that all your basic life necessities are met. And obviously there's a lot of context here, right? Like, this is just in, you know, sort of like developed nations, I guess you could say. This is a North American study. So obviously this number changes all over the world. But you're right. Like, wealth doesn't equate happiness. So then why?
So enough wealth equates happiness in terms of access and education.
Absolutely. You need to meet your bare necessities.
Yeah, food and all that kind of stuff.
Critically important.
Right. And you have enough money for some fun in terms of like actually like.
Yeah. And some security and safety.
Right.
You know, there's this big notion that I've been pushing, and we're starting to see conversations happening in the corporate sector, which is amazing, which is around this notion of living wage.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, what, how much does somebody need to be paid in order to have those basic necessities covered for them? And it is shocking and terrible to think that there are tons of people who are working jobs where they're not paid a living wage.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And when you take that further, what that actually means is those businesses and the systems that are, you know, like the businesses that buy from those businesses and like so forth, the whole system is essentially based on a model where labor is exploitive, right? Which is I mean, horrible in so many ways.
But that is actually a model. Like
that is the current model.
But also to study history, that is the model we've inherited. It feels like it's always been exploitative.
It has always been exploitative.
Right. So it becomes, maybe we're less exploitative in terms of like, we have human rights now, or we have the rights of, you know, children that can't work now where they used to be, you know, like there's a few things that kind of protect folks, but not enough to actually create safe well-being and meaningful work.
Absolutely. And I mean, I've been talking about this forever, but reasons why I think that it's still persistent and movements to change that. I mean, there is a lot of work going mm-hmm. in that direction, which is amazing. And I think technology and communication has really helped sort of shed a light mm-hmm. on all of this. But going back to your original question about like, how do I feel about this and like, what does it mean? So when I was an auditor in Canada and like, look, I value audit. I think, you know, reliable information that's accurate is critically important for decision making. And that's a lot of what auditors do. But at the end of the day, the question for me was like, what was I working towards? Helping people who were rich become richer, right? Like helping myself, who I already felt like I was very, very well off, like gain more wealth. But again, for what? And I think our current system and culture, and this is where I think a lot of my faith comes into, is we sort of value ourselves based on like materialism, mm-hmm. things that we own are like, and our achievements. And like so much of that is like wrapped up in this whole like consumption production economy. It's a very capitalistic viewpoint on how worthy someone mm-hmm. is. And I think ultimately at the end of the day, that's what people are chasing. Mm-hmm. And to huge detriment to millions of people mm-hmm. around the globe and also to our planet. So a lot of the work that I'm doing is trying to, you know, we're talking about like, what's this right side up? Mm-hmm. Like looking at power systems or like a power shift, like can we change capitalism? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the work that I do in corporate social responsibility, or my actual title has the term ESG in it, environmental, social, and governance, is like, sometimes people call it caring capitalism. Mm-hmm. And so it's partially this idea that it's like more, it's just like a more inclusive, like the greater well-being, more happiness, like a more caring mm-hmm. way of building our society. Like, is this society the way we have, is this what we really want for our lives? Mm-hmm. Is this really want for our children and for our communities? Really? This?
Right.
Is this what we want? This structure and system we put in place? Or do we want something else? And like, but how do we get there? Mm-hmm. How do you change the systems? And I think I've flip-flopped all over the place. Mm-hmm. Is it public policy and government? Mm-hmm. Is it working in an NGO and being an activist, right? Mm-hmm. Is it teaching the next generation? Or right now I'm back to maybe it's working from within mm-hmm. and trying to actually, and this is what I do a lot of my job, and I don't know if I should really be saying this out loud, but it's like working with and getting to know the hearts of those who have tremendous power and resources. Mm-hmm. And can we kind of...
try to get them to think differently.
Yeah.
Ask different questions.
That's it. Can we stir their hearts in a way?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, like we hate to admit this, but mm-hmm. it is the truth of how our systems are set up now, that mm-hmm. those with power and resources have an outsized impact.
Yeah.
Right?
It is monopoly.
It is. So
if they hold all the most properties and they have all, they acquire the most wealth, and they win the game. That's what's happening right now. But for what?
Yeah.
And I think that even that question to ask people with that, and even for me, like for my power and my influence, and for what? What is this for? Like in the end, and you have this, I feel like this mythical, almost like very Rome-esque, through our media and our outlets, sort of perpetuating the myth that wealth will make you happy, even though it seems glaringly obvious that it won't and doesn't, according to the stats and according to the lives of people who are overly wealthy. So you're constantly like, okay, we know this myth isn't true, and yet we all still believe it because we're like prone to believe this. So then you have these, I would say, like whistleblower types, but you're like a kind whistleblower who's like blowing the whistle on yourself, even saying like, what is my impact on the world? Like, what can I do? And what are some of the things that I can change And what can I do with the skills that I've acquired and the knowledge that I have? And rather than demonize people, which is, you know, I feel like your first awakening is like to demonize everyone. Like, you're corporate, you Elon Musk is the devil, you know, like whatever the thing is. And then eventually you mature enough, maybe with the inner work you do in yourself, going, oh, this is hard. This is hard to change this value, even inside of me, to a little bit more of a benevolent, but also like a more strategic, I would say, inside out strategy, where you're like, what if we worked with people to try to change some things together? Is there such a thing as caring capitalism? Can we do it, do you think?
There's certainly a huge effort to try. Let me tell you. You know, I love that you mentioned that, because in taking my most recent job, I really questioned whether I was selling out, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Am I just going back, like, pretending that we can fix something from within, that we can improve the current system, right? Mm-hmm. Or should I just go back to the stay outside of it, demonize it, try to, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know,
it might be back and forth. You might have to go both ways.
Yeah, maybe. But to your point, it's like, well, you know, you and I have had this conversation a lot about like calling and what's your purpose and what should mm-hmm. you be doing. But it was like an opportunity that was in front of me. I seemed to have the right sort of skills and experiences and relationships to maybe make a difference here. And mm-hmm. who knows, maybe I turned the hearts of two people, but they were two really critical people.
Yeah. That can affect the living wage of thousands, tens of thousands of people
all over, domestically and across the globe.
And then you think, even just that living wage conversation, and that's determined by a standard of living and a percentage of, so another project that I'm working on right now sort of says, if you're spending more than 70% of income on your housing, you are lacking in resources. You don't have any sense of like changing your life or taking a holiday or saving for, you know, anything like that. So a living wage takes all those sort of things in mind to say, like, this is how much it would be to have proper housing.
You got it.
Yeah. To be able to then afford your groceries, to be able to grid.
The methodology around it. It's like two adults, one kid in school, one kid who's in daycare. In the geography where they live, how much does it cost to have a home, to pay for very basic extracurriculars, food, you know, utilities and so forth. But it doesn't include things like saving for retirement. It doesn't include things like saving for your kids post-secondary, for example. So it is a very conservative number. I
think. So what would be the living wage in Toronto? Toronto is one of the most expensive cities in the world to live in.
It is.
So
what do you think on a per hour basis? What's a living wage?
Oh, $25.
Close. It's like $22.08 or something
okay.
like that.
Okay.
And the living wage has to be updated every year as costs and things change.
Right.
You know, but you can think through. I think it's like somewhere around $46,000 for a family. Like, I'm curious, the people who are listening, what do they think? Do they think that is
a living wage?
Is it too high? Is it too low? And I'd also challenge people, you know,
try living on it.
We'll try living on it, but like, what are you paying your babysitters or your cleaners or the person who comes to maybe help you, I don't know, with your backyard or the people in your life, right?
Right.
I think they're interesting. You know, you and I also talk a lot about changing systems. That's also like, what do you do in your own lives individually? Yes. And I think this is one thing to maybe think about. But I do want to go back to your question about, is caring capitalism even possible? It's a good question. And there's so much conversation about like capitalism and societies right now because a couple of big factors. I think one is climate change.
Yes.
And another one is actually technology and this like rise of automation and like, are robots going to come and take all our jobs? And then like, what do we all do? And what does it mean? There's conversations about universal basic income. There's like a whole bunch of stuff. I think we're re-looking at like, hey, what is the purpose of life? And like, is our whole purpose just to like go be put to work and be as efficient as possible and we're just gonna make in perpetuity and like that's it or not? But I do see movements toward caring capitalism. There's a huge movement to try to better measure, and like this is obviously coming from my background as an accountant, but like, can we start to measure the other impacts that companies have on the world? Mm-hmm. So there's this idea, it's called total societal value. So right now when you look at a company and like you're trying to decide where you want to invest your retirement savings or whatever it might be,
right?
You look at a set of financial statements and it shows, you know, how much money a company makes in a year, net profit. The idea of total societal value is like, okay, well, that's good, they made economic profit, mm-hmm. but if you pull in all of their social impacts, all of their environmental impacts, are they net good or net bad for society? Mm. So you can have a company who shows a net profit, but let's just say a really egregious thing. I don't know. They're dumping tons of chemicals into a river behind them, and it's making tons of people sick. It's like it's this big strain on the healthcare system. People are dying.
And they're making their products in sweatshops, and people are dying out of work conditions.
Right. So, you'd be like, okay, well, on paper, if you look at their financial statements, it looks like they're a good company. They make a profit. But if you look at their total impacts over the whole world, I think we would all agree, negative.
Right.
So how do we actually pull that thinking into our current capitalist sort of structures, our financial markets and so forth, so that we, so people know that.
And that's great. So that they can see that. You're widening the measurement just from value equals money to value equals money, life, environmental factors, human
all
cost.
Of those pieces. And then the idea is that if we can do that, we can make different decisions about what companies we would support and not. Right?
Wow.
And so that work is underway, and it has been underway for decades. And
so that work is hard because the people that have all the money don't want that measurement maybe out. Or do you feel like there is a turn? So this is interesting because I feel like a previous, and this is where power shift comes in. Like, when is it that the power shifts? Like, how does the power shift actually happen? And sometimes it starts like just like little tiny a loosening of like the grip of that old power. But then there's this like, you know, there's this crossover threshold where there's enough. So I just wonder even generationally where we're thinking, like my kid, you know, is captivated by the idea of saving the planet. I think everyone his age is, you know, just like we can't keep living like this. They own it, you know, it's there. And so I wonder if like this generation, enough of us have asked like what, why, how, and even those questions are starting to dictate the way that we do business, or this has been going on for a long time. You think we're at a tipping point, or what would help the power shift?
You know, I think in the work that I do, especially when I was consulting in it, was on this notion like next year is going to be the year we're going to really see big change, you know, like or next year we're really, and it's just like year after year and didn't feel like we're moving anywhere. I do think we're moving somewhere though now.
Interesting.
I think COVID has exposed a lot of like, it made people rethink about meaning and purpose in their lives, right?
And like, maybe the pace they were living, like, did I really need to work 80 hours a week to,
and for what? Or like, you know, being home with their families for the first, like, be out in nature for the first, like, I think there was a lot. I think COVID did expose a lot. I do think the newer generations, I mean, they are inheriting a
broken,
very broken world and system, and it's up to them to fix it. So I think there is greater, for sure, interest and momentum in this space. But I also work with a lot of, I'll put it out there, like 60-year-old white men. Like, and I'm perceiving a shift in how they think about the world. And I know I'm just painting like a real broad stroke of brush here. And there's
all kinds
of different people. But I do think it's a genuine heart shift. And
interesting. Like almost an awakening, maybe too. I wonder.
I perceive it to be. Yeah, I do.
That's cool. I mean, because I think the other thing I was thinking about with capitalism, and this is a big subject, but like I often think we, and I did this study on sort of even how suburbia was made, and I never realized this. And this is crazy because when I think about it for a minute, I realize it. But it's not forever. It's not ancient. Capitalism isn't an ancient thing that we've inherited. It's an experiment. Like it's a social experiment. I think we say, you know, we believe that communism was an experiment as well, and it failed. And then we have sort of some other countries that are doing like a hybrid, like a more of a socialism, a capitalistic socialism type of a thing that happens in Europe and Sweden and Finland and things like that. So I feel like before it used to be this big fight. You were either a capitalist or you were a communist. And it was like communists are the worst and capitalists are the best. And this is a system that's going to, and then we sort of like in this experiment realized, ooh, there's some problems with this way we do life here. And it might not be as successful as we once hoped and thought it would be. So it has to be adjusted.
And we have the agency to change it too. I think people sometimes feel like you're just stuck. You can't do anything about it.
Right.
So one thing that's fascinating in teaching is, so like I teach MBA students, right? Yeah. So you would think they'd be coming in there pro-capitalism, which they were for sure at the beginning.
Yes.
But the last cohort of MBA students I taught one of the very first lecture, I already had, you know, at least half the classes putting up their hand wanting to question the value of capitalism as an organizing structure.
Wow.
For society to begin with, which wow. I think is fascinating for a bunch of business students.
Yes.
And The Economist, I don't know if anyone's interested in this, you know, kind of geeky stuff, but let's say maybe a year ago, 2 years ago, their cover article was called The Rise of Millennial Socialism.
Mm-hmm.
So again, right? Like yes. bringing back different ways of thinking. And to your point, like some of it we feel like is so ingrained in society, but I think there's other parts that are like, you know, people are like kind of peeling back the covers a bit and looking at it and being like, well, what do we actually think about this, right? Like I know I have friends in my circle who are, let's say, like higher income earners who are very willing to pay higher taxes.
Right.
Right? And right. so like, I don't know if that was necessarily the case 3 decades ago.
Right.
And,
or with everybody. But
or with everybody for sure. But just like this, like I think there is some some different thinking around this. And truthfully, like, you know, I'll say it. Like I'm obviously a very idealistic person.
Yeah.
But I think
that's why we get along.
That is why we get along. Because I think if you
eternally
don't,
optimistic is how
don't
I put
have
it.
Some optimism. Okay, actually, it's funny. It's funny you mentioned this. So people often say, like, Lindsay, like, are you optimistic that the company you work at is actually going to change? Right, that they're going to take a much longer term view of the world. Like, truthfully, optimistically, probably no.
Right.
But I still have hope.
Yes.
So I have, like, you know. Maybe not greater than 50% chance that it's going to happen, but it's also not a 0% chance. Like
yes.
I still, and I think anybody who's trying to shift power or turn things around and are continuing to stay engaged with these really complex systems-based issues, you have to have some hope, you know, that there is change.
Well, and I also think when a lot of these, during this last couple of years, a lot of other issues have come up, like racism and systemic racism and stuff, and I think there's been an exposure enough to realize that economics and the economic system that we have play a major role in a lot of that systemic oppression. And so I think that also then made these questions like, wait a minute, I thought capitalism was the way everyone was going to rise up by their bootstraps and make it, you know, equity was going to be championed by capitalism. And we're like, oh, I see. It's not. So I think a lot of that. Now, talk to me about the Buy Nothing group that you started in your own local community. And this sounds like a stretch, but it isn't, because I want to go from these big, huge issues, which I love, even if all we do are raise the questions and people can genuinely say, actually, those are good questions. Is my net gain of wealth the sum zero of my life and the total of how I want to measure my company or measure my success or whatever? Those questions are really good. What does give me value and how do I share that value with the world? And, you know, I think those are good, not just for companies to ask, but even people, you know, what gives you value? What is it that you're offering the world? What's your net zero impact? So I feel like Buy Nothing brings it back down to a neighborhood level. Like, what are some alternative ways or ways that we can invoke the imagination of measuring things differently and doing things differently?
Oh, I could talk about Buy Nothing for a long time, Danielle. Okay, so for those of you who aren't familiar, the Buy Nothing movement is actually a very subversive cultural movement that just looks like a free buy and sell group on Facebook.
Right.
Okay? So they're meant to be hyper-local. You probably have one in your own neighborhood. And when you look at it, it kind of feels transactionary, you know, just like put stuff up there that you don't want anymore. Mm-hmm. And then somebody can grab it and you can grab stuff that people don't want anymore too.
It's like an exchange.
It's
like, I've got this. Does anyone need a size 8 pair of boots for a kid?
You got it. Yeah. And 3 people will be like, yes, my feet are size 8 or my kid's feet are size 8. Yeah. I love those boots. And then, you know, you pass them along. So, you know, on one level, that is what it is. And from like an environmental standpoint, it's great because you're obviously not having to buy anything new.
It's like a thrift store with no middleman.
You got it. That's exactly it. And there's no money and you can like pass things along and it's really helpful. In that way. But the reason why, but I think it's subversive in a couple different ways. Uh-huh. So one, is that the idea of buy nothing. And so we actually talk about, we call it like a gifting economy as opposed to like a market-based sort of capitalistic economy. So in a gifting economy, it's this notion that we have everything that we would ever need. for healthy, happy lives already within our own community, mm-hmm. if we work together.
If we would share.
If we would share and yeah. work together, which yeah. is so different. We know we keep saying, like, what are the values that underline current culture today? So much of it is individualism. Mm-hmm. It's all about me for me. Mm-hmm. I'm protecting myself, right? I'm amassing things for my own.
Right.
It's very
I can't just appreciate things. I have to own them now yes. for them to have value.
That's right. exactly it.
Right.
And there's no, it's like a big focus on, like, independence versus mm-hmm. interdependence.
Right.
And buy nothing's all about fostering interdependence.
Right.
So take it to its extreme. It would be somebody says, hey, I'm cold. Does anyone have a coat I could have?
Mm-hmm.
And I have one coat. Mm-hmm. It's my only coat. I know I'm going to need that coat later. It will get cold and I will want it. But I'm comfortable giving my coat to that person because I know that when I need a coat next, I'll be able to go to my community and somebody will be able to give me a coat.
Right.
So it's fostering that idea of interdependence, which I really love. There's so many amazing stories in this benefit group. I can't even explain. Like, there was one woman who asked for a chainsaw because she needed to fix something in her tree. And then not only did she get a chainsaw, she had, like, someone come by with a chainsaw who's going to help her. Someone who ended up being an arborist coming by her property and helping her fix her tree. Someone showed up with a ladder, and then somebody cut it. Like, it was just this, like, and this happens, you know, multiple times a day. Mm-hmm. And I think, and the reason I love it so much and why I think it's, like, sort of countercultural and subversive, two reasons. It really fosters in real life relationships,
mm-hmm.
not this like digital something or where you're just like dropping something off and someone's porch, you're not actually seeing
right.
them.
You it's, meet your neighbor.
You are actually meeting mm-hmm. your neighbor and you're getting to know them.
Right.
And then the other reason why I really love it is because I think people actually want to be connected in community mm-hmm. and our current culture is not really doing that.
Yes.
Right. So it's like growing that sense of neighborliness and community and like mutual dependence.
And then I also think people want to give, like, I think people want to share
so much,
don't know how,
and
then the middleman takes away sort of the connectedness. So you can write a check to a charity or you can, but that's different from actually sharing your life and sharing your things and meeting people and like taking away the stigma of receiving as well as giving too. Like, I like that about the Buy Nothing group, sort
Absolutely.
Of everyone could receive and everyone can give. There's no sort of who's needy and who's not needy.
Yeah.
There's no mention of that on the,
there isn't. And so actually one rule that gets debated a lot in my Buy Nothing group is that, you know, if somebody says, hey, I have this pair of winter boots, that you're not allowed to come on and be like, so-and-so shelter needs boots. Why don't you give it to them? Your neighbor can afford to buy boots.
Right.
You just give it to the shelter.
Right.
But the whole idea of Buy Nothing, though, is that there shouldn't be haves and there have-nots.
Right.
It shouldn't be all the rich haves giving all their castaways down to the have-nots.
Right.
Right. That just, like, you know,
perpetuates the distance.
Perpetuates the distance.
Yeah.
Giving to a neighbor who comes and talks to you about why they need those boots or what they're doing that weekend.
Right.
Right. That's the piece that, like, mm-hmm. you know, I talked to you earlier about, like, the work that I was doing and this whole idea of stirring hearts. I think it really starts so local.
Mm-hmm.
It's like trying to get people to trust each other
yeah.
again, to see the value in building strong, healthy societies. What is it like? And to know what it's like to live a life where you can rely on other people.
Open it
you.
Up. Yeah.
And I think that's,
and then you're, in a sense, you're practicing too, right? You're practicing something that you don't do naturally in
yes.
the way our life. So as you practice that, then your life becomes more and more and more and more open.
That's exactly
to even people
it.
Outside of your neighborhood. Like, then it
yes.
becomes a much more open way to live. You also drew the boundary though of your Buy Nothing group in different, so that it overlaps some socioeconomic realities within your city.
Absolutely.
With that intention as well, right? It's widening the neighborhood.
It is. And
yeah.
it kind of gets you to meet different people too.
Yeah.
But to your point about the distance, I think that's why sort of corporate Canada, maybe capitalism is not the right word, but why our sort of current capital markets, we're starting to see, we have problems like slave labor and supply chains and
yes.
poor environmental practices and exploitation of people and like, and I think it's your point, it's the distance that's created, right?
Right.
Like, I challenge people right now, anybody who has an investment, you know, a mutual fund that your retirement savings are sitting in,
mm-hmm.
right? How much do you know about those companies that
Nothing.
You're investing, right? You are so far from the money that's
yes.
being invested.
Yeah.
And then think about, like, management of those companies, right? They are so far
mm-hmm.
from where the factories or that stuff is being produced are.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that, you know? So, like, when you don't think about it, it's mm-hmm. so easy to forget.
Right.
Right? The distance is just...
They literally are nameless, faceless, I don't even know they exist, invisible people on the end of some company's supply chain that I don't...
Exactly.
Yeah. But I'm still benefiting from their labor.
You are.
Yes.
And it's so hard to pull the two together. Like, you know, so I sit on the board of Fair Trade Canada. It's something extremely important to me. And when I talk to people about it, it's like, I never want people to feel bad, but like, did you know a lot of the chocolate in our supply chain comes from, especially like comes from West Africa, mm-hmm. has like child slave labor in it, mm-hmm. right?
Like 80%.
And I guarantee you mm-hmm. that if I took, you know, say my best friend and put her in West Africa and she mm-hmm. saw those kids working, she would literally give the actual clothing off of her back mm-hmm. to try to improve the situation. And she would take them home and mm-hmm. she would cuddle them and she would give everything that she had to try to fix that situation.
Yeah.
But way on this side of the world mm-hmm. is Nestle in her investment mm-hmm. portfolio.
Right.
Potentially.
Yeah.
Right?
Probably.
And
they own everything, right?
They do. It's really hard to avoid Nestle. And I'm not saying Nestle's bad for people who...
I am.
But there are also, you know, everyone is working...
Hopefully. There are equally bad. But Lindsay's not saying that, but I'm saying I...
Okay, I also have learned, you know, I think it's really hard to paint, like, broad strokes, like... Because I think if we discount people and companies yeah. and individuals, it's you're just never going to get moving.
The biggest the capitalist company, the more, you know, is. Problems there are going to be in terms of that lack of transparency and that, like, bottom line dollar and the expense of human capital.
Back to the Bad Nothing Group.
Right.
This distance.
Yes.
That makes it so hard.
So
right?
raging against the distance.
We are. And so Buy Nothing at its core is trying to close that distance
right.
in real hyper-local ways. And to
yes.
your point, you start to do that immediately in our own lives. I would hope
mm-hmm. it would start spreading out.
Spreading everywhere.
And fair trade, again, that's transparency and supply chain. That's kind of one of its main, and maybe we'll be able to explore a bit more with them.
Mm-hmm.
But that transparency, again, taking the distance out. These are not just farmers from like some invisible place that you hope are getting decently paid. You know where they're coming from and what they're doing and how much they're getting paid.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite fair trade commercials, I think came out of Fair Trade Belgium. And mm-hmm. so it was like, I don't know, anyone who's listening to this right now, if you get groceries delivered mm-hmm. to your door, right? You know, there's like produce boxes
yeah.
or whatever. And so, you know, I think when people are looking at them, they're kind of looking at quality, but they're also looking at price and everyone's.
Yeah.
And then so this commercial had all the grocery boxes being delivered to people's homes. And obviously it was a stunt at the time,
yeah.
but it was like this like raggedy old truck that came and like kids who were dressed in rags, like these tiny little kids
wow.
like, lifting these boxes and like giving it to
right.
you as you open your door.
Wow.
And everyone's like, you know, all the homeowners were shocked. I never would buy this. Like, this is
right.
terrible. Like blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And then there'd be an adult be like, well, you wanted the best price. You wanted the cheapest.
Mm.
And
wow.
This
is what
that,
this is what
this
that
is what
means
to happen on the
right.
other end of the world. But once again, it's like
wow.
so in the work that I do, I and again as the idealist, I guess, means I think people fundamentally are good and want to be mm-hmm. kind, they want to be connected.
Yeah.
And but our system mm-hmm. and like what's around us can make it very challenging mm-hmm. to do so.
Yeah. And because, again, back to that capitalistic myth and like even all the advertisements and stuff, we're not really sure. It's really hard to know what to believe.
It is.
So then it's really hard not to just resign ourselves to the inevitable, you know, because we don't know what's true and what's not true. So like it does require a lot of homework and willingness to go like, what are the best sources to find out how we might, you know, do a better job at buying from decently. Like where are there places we could go where I could just go, I want to shop at these stores that at least have some sort of ethical quality of production. Are there any go-to places?
So you're asking a really good question.
Mm.
One that I personally have a lot of anxiety about right. Because
there's no perfect system.
There is no perfect system.
I get it.
And it's really challenging. And like, listen to everyone who's listening. I really feel for us. Like we make,
yeah.
thousands of decisions a day.
Yes.
You're standing in a grocery store to be
yes.
like, okay, there's 8 yogurts or
right.
25 yogurts I'm looking to
which
buy.
Which yogurt's the one?
Which yogurt's the right one?
Yeah.
Do I know enough about all these companies and how they treat their people
right.
and what and how they
which
treat
is why
their
a fair
job?
Trade exists.
So there are lots of certifications. Obviously,
yeah.
of course, I definitely support fair trade.
Yeah.
And not all certifications are created the same. Some are more
right.
stringent, some are less, you know.
Rainforest Alliance is like what I call fair trade light.
Yes, you know, again, in the spirit of like not bashing other organizations.
Yeah, no, but like it's something. It's better than
it
nothing.
And you know what? It has a different philosophy, right?
Right.
It's like, you know, if
environmental
if
impact over light, human rights.
If it's a slightly less rigorous system, then maybe it
can go,
you know,
further.
Right. Or attracts like the people who might not be able to meet. And
yes.
But this exists. So yes, fair trade I think is good. Truthfully, you know, like you could Google ethical clothing stores and so forth. My big thing is actually just trying to avoid consuming to the extent possible.
Right.
Right. It's,
right.
And like that sort of like eliminates a lot of the decisions. So like thrift when you can, secondhand,
yes.
hand-me-downs.
Yes.
Share.
Yeah.
Do you really need to buy that chainsaw, or can you just borrow a neighbor's? Or
right.
Look, do you have a tool library in your neighborhood? Use your actual public libraries. I'm a big fan of public libraries too.
Which are on the decline.
No.
Well, I mean, just the usage of libraries are on the decline because of, I don't know if it's partly COVID related, but also because it's just easier to get it from Amazon than to get in line for a book. So again, it's just back to this consuming culture, right? Being so extreme.
It's a real problem. That actually makes me really sad. And just as a side note, did you know Toronto Public Library is the world's largest urban public library system?
Is it?
It is. In terms of circulation, use, we have over 100 branches.
They have great libraries.
They do. Mm-hmm. I think libraries are also really important as a democratizing force because it enables access to information, conversation, and ideas for everybody regardless. But yes, I think it is really hard for an individual consumer to make all the right choices. And again, anyone who's listening to this, and thinking like feeling some anxiety about it all, because I certainly do. Like,
yeah, I know? Do too. I feel anxiety all the time about it. I feel anxiety about what I'm wearing,
yes,
what it means,
exactly.
What I'm representing,
who
I'm supporting. I mean, and it is really anxiety inducing. And at the same time, you can do what you can with what you have when you can as well. So like there is a sense in which, okay, but even asking the questions good, even the anxiety I think is good. There should be some anxiety in participating in a system that's so oppressive to people around the world.
Yes,
I want to feel bad about it.
You should feel uncomfortable.
That's
with
right.
It. Absolutely. So,
but then I want to jump to the solutions real quick. So I remember like years ago, Kevin Bale's organization was working on like a supply chain map and like trying to come up with like a certification, but around trafficking for organizations, that you could have the certification. It would mean at least you don't have trafficking in your supply chain that we can find.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. All good caveats.
Uh-huh.
There are some solutions. So one, I want to address like that, like feeling of uncomfortableness that I'm sure people have, like know that I think it is unfair that the current system right now pushes all the responsibility on you, Danielle.
Yes.
You should know
where
your clothes come from and
the
new guitar that you bought or that book and where it was printed and was it, you know, is it like soy-based ink on recycled paper?
Right.
I think it's totally incorrect. Like, I do this for a job. And I find it impossible to know all the things or to feel comfortable.
Right.
So I think we do have to acknowledge, like, the systems that are in place that just make it really hard for people to be able to make the right choices. So I think, you know, any work that you're saying, talking about solutions and what can individual people do is like work to like change those systems. So it does actually matter where you invest your money, right? Even if you just asked whoever, your financial advisor, your bank, whatever it might be, it's like, hey, I'm interested in like sustainable investing or ESG investing or ethical investing. Just tell me about it. Even if nothing changes, even if they don't really know what to say to you,
right?
At least you've asked the question.
Yes.
And they're registering more people. The other thing that actually has outsized influence, as like a person who's worked in like retail and consumer goods companies exclusively in that industry, is like literally write that email to Loblaws. Write that email.
That stuff
to
matters
Walmart.
More than you can think.
It truly does.
Yes.
As was the person on the other side who's like, look, consumers care. They want those fair trade bananas,
right?
They want to know that everyone in our supply chain is paid a living wage or that we don't have child labor.
Right.
Like, to have those messages actually is really...
Feedback to companies, and we were part of the chocolate campaign years ago where we just took these little cards into every shop and it said like, if you stock fair trade chocolate, we'll buy it. And it was like, but we're not buying what's here. And right. we just like, we literally like had thousands of young people distribute this to all of the shops. And it like, they started stocking fair trade chocolate because the companies started going, even if they're not benevolent about it. And they're like, oh, we can't wait to be an ethical change. They're like, whoa, our consumer base is yeah. changing their preferences.
It is.
So that's the joy of redeeming capitalism is capitalism should be driven by consumers. And if our consumers change our tastes, then ideally capitalism shifts that's with it. It.
And
but there has to be enough of us that do it, I guess, is the...
There does.
Yes.
But I get it.
Yeah.
We are tired. We are stressed.
Yes.
Stressed. We have a thousand other things to worry about.
Yes.
Changing capitalism is not high on the list on your to-do list today, right? But, like, these small things to make... And I also do want to caveat and say, like, I don't think capitalism is that. It has, like, raised standards of living across the entire
yes.
world. It is the reason for tons of innovation and like progress and like it's improved, you know, health and well-being everywhere. But I do think it's maybe been taken a bit to the extreme now.
Yeah. And time to just tweak. We're not saying like down with capitalism. We're just saying there's maybe another way to do this thing.
Yeah. And I guess the last thing I'd say in terms of like individual action would be like voting really matters.
Mm.
I know it feels like it doesn't. Like I understand that.
Well, but how you vote, why you vote matters. That's the thing. So like, and this actually, this back to a capitalist, extreme capitalist mindset is like, when you vote, do you vote for the politician that offers you the best tax break?
Yeah.
And again, this is back to companies where it's like, what is the bottom line? What is the measure of a party that you're for? Is it that they'll balance the budget? Like that's the party you want. And that's like the primary. And again, this is like capitalistic thinking, right? Like an investment. Or what's the zero sum? Like what is the impact of this party on those without access or the poor or those who struggle to make a living wage and things like
that. That's right. Are you voting just for yourself or are you voting on behalf of other people? And this
right.
is like a challenge with capitalism too, is like right now in North America, companies have to report their earnings every 3 months.
Mm.
And then people invest in those companies or don't invest in those companies.
Based on their
earnings. So when a company's trying to make it, you know, they're obviously trying to show like some profit, I guess, every 3 months. Of
right.
course it pushes short-term thinking, right?
Yes.
We need longer-term thinking. Same thing happens in our election systems, right? You're thinking, like, what's good for me for the next 4 years?
Which right.
But we know in the long term,
yes,
you know, inequality is bad. It leads to civic unrest, mm-hmm. right? It leads to, like...
We pay the bill for that eventually, either before or after.
Stable society,
yeah.
like, huge decreases in health and well-being. So, like,
yeah.
you know, strong, stable, healthy societies are good for everybody, mm. always, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's just trying to like pull our heads out of that really short-term individual thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I think the last thing, I guess, is obviously comes from me being a mother, but like maybe try and teach our kids a different set of values or a different way of looking like mm-hmm. at the world, at people, the relationship with things, mm-hmm. how they
you how know, to share.
Yeah, how to share, but also like how they think about their own self-worth and
yeah.
and what things are important to them and how. So I took my eldest Lucas, he would have been 6 at the time, to the climate marches that were happening in Toronto in 2018.
Yeah.
And I literally stood there weeping, just mm. seeing, it was like a sea of children,
mm.
you know?
Right.
And, you know, thinking like outside of themselves, broadly speaking, but also saying to government, we have no power. We need mm-hmm. you to
yes.
take care of us.
Yes.
Will you please?
Right.
And it was so...
Which is also if not only politicians, but if business owners and new mm-hmm. business starters and all are paying attention, this generation cares. Like they are already measuring impact differently.
They absolutely mm-hmm. care. And so I have a lot of hope for people coming through.
Mm-hmm.
These are really
yeah.
difficult, sticky situations. Like,
and it is a shift. You know, we feel the shift. And that's why, as an expert, it's helpful. Like the way that you've communicated this is so helpful in so many ways. But also, I love what you do with your life. I think it is a calling.
I really hope
and
it is.
And affirm
I don't
it.
Know.
No, it really is. What is a calling? Right? I mean, what does it mean to live your life for others and in the pursuit of making other people feel loved and known and welcomed? You're doing that. It's beautiful.
I
hope
so.
Yeah. Locally, socially, big. Let's just change capitalism. That's basically what we're saying.
Go join your Buy Nothing group.
Thanks, Lindsay.
Bye.
Thank you.
Brave Global is an organization that is near and dear to my heart. It seeks to come alongside and coach communities and churches and groups, nonprofits, in how to reach vulnerable girls before they're trafficked. It is such an incredible strategy. And there's journals, there's a new journal out. There's a book of survivor stories that's just come out called Brave in Real Life. There are, there's so many things. There's events that you could host. There are Brave Circle support groups. There are just so many things that are on offer in order to mobilize people to help in the fight against trafficking. And there's never been a better time to get involved in this than right now. So please go to braveglobal.org, or if you're in Canada, braveglobalcanada.org, and check out all of Brave, and please join us in this fight. It is so key right now.